Saturday morning in the paradise that is Hawaii, and a little after 8 a.m., as you sip your coffee to start your day, your cell phone suddenly goes off with a harsh alert, and you can't believe what you're reading on it, so you turn on the TV, and that's when you hear...
The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you are indoors, stay indoors. If you are outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building. Remain indoors well away from windows. If you are driving, pull safely to the side of the road and seek shelter in a building or lay on the floor. We will announce when the threat has ended. This is not a drill. Take immediate action measures.
When you hear something like that, even when it later proves to be a false alarm, you immediately feel in your guts and in your bones the reality of that extremely heated seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we catch you up with the nuclear news from around the world, including a Fukushima update with Nancy Faust of simplyinfo.org, and a rundown on all those mysterious radiation leaks from somewhere in Eastern Europe from Sean McGee of nuclear-news.net. Plus, we'll have numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness. So many in competition this week. The duck and cover report on what's gone wrong with those leaking nuclear rust bucket reactors, and more honest nuclear information than I was able to handle during my 2 weeks down with the flu. All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 16, 2018, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Hawaii was shaken by a false ballistic missile alert last Saturday, January 13. We will have a lot more about this in today's final thought. The Hanford site in southeastern Washington state, one of the 10 most radioactive sites on the planet, has been in the news a lot lately. On December 27th, we learned that 19 vehicles have been found with what are being called specks of radioactive material from the plutonium finishing plant. 12 government or contractor vehicles have been found with radioactive contamination out of only 31 that had been tested. That's over one-third were found with contamination, and there are 55 vehicles still left to be surveyed. The homes of 7 Hanford nuclear reservation workers are being inspected after a spread of radioactive contamination in recent days. Each of these workers had one of the contaminated vehicles and requested surveys of their homes to make certain they had not tracked contamination home. No results have been announced as yet. Almost 2 years ago, as of February 22, 2016, the Environmental Protection Agency called the uncontrolled spread of small amounts of radioactive waste at Hanford alarming after a windstorm. Surveys 6 miles north of Richland after the wind subsided found specks, that word again, specks of contamination had spread beyond Route 4, the public highway from Richland out to the Y Barricade secure entrance to Hanford. The spread of these radioactive particles is said to be created by plants or animals, possibly contaminated tumbleweed fragments discovered during ground surveys in and around the plutonium finishing plant. Perhaps in light of all of this information, the Washington State Labor and Commerce Committee on Wednesday, January 10th, revived a bill to help sick Hanford workers, It would give workers who came down with certain illnesses the presumption that their exposure to chemicals, heavy metals, and/or radiation at the nuclear cleanup site caused their diseases, such as cancer, toxic encephalopathy, dementia, and lung disease. In a story that broke just last week, drinking water for more than 170 million Americans contains radioactive elements at levels that may increase the risk of cancer. This according to an environmental working group analysis of 2010 to 2015 test results from public water systems nationwide. Radiation in tap water is a serious health threat, especially during pregnancy. But the Environmental Protection Agency's legal limits for several types of radioactive elements in tap water are badly outdated. And to make matters worse, President Trump's nominee to be the White House environment czar rejects the need for water systems to comply even with those outdated and inadequate standards. The nominee, Kathleen Hartnett White, former chair of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, admitted in a 2011 interview that the commission falsified data to make it appear that communities with excessive radiation levels were below the EPA's limit. She said she did not, quote, believe the science of health effects, end quote, to which the EPA subscribes, placing, quote, far more trust, end quote, in the work of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which has a reputation of setting polluter-friendly state standards and casually enforcing federal standards. On January 8th of this year, the White House renominated her for her role, setting up another confirmation vote before the committee and then the full Senate. And now it's time for the Duck and Cover Report on what's gone wrong with the aging nuclear reactors in the United States. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, Massachusetts, had an unplanned manual shutdown on Monday, January 1st. This was during the run-up to the Arctic Bomb Cyclone Polar Vortex storm that struck the East Coast. One of only two power lines that provide power to the Plymouth facility, quote-unquote, became unavailable, meaning it went down. And this is the energy that actually runs the plant, so their power supply was cut in half. Note that Pilgrim is officially one of the three worst-performing nuclear reactors in the country and is one step away from a federally mandated shutdown. The Oyster Creek nuclear plant in New Jersey, the nation's oldest operating nuclear facility, declared an unusual event, the first step on the four-step Nuclear Regulatory Commission scale to kiss your ass goodbye, on Saturday, January 6th. After unusually low tides and high winds impacted the water levels in its intake canal. Without enough water available, they can't cool that sucker. The good news. It's official that the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant near San Luis Obispo in California is going to close. The not-so-good news? It's going to take 7 years until 2025 for both of the facilities there to shut down, despite the fact that they are in proximity to earthquake faults, one of them just 650 yards away. You should shoot them now to put them out of their misery. Duck! Over to Japan, where five more people in Fukushima Prefecture, who were 18 and under at the time of the 2011 nuclear accident, have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer as of the end of September of 2017. This according to a prefectural investigative commission, which announced it at a December 25th meeting. A total of 159 Fukushima prefectural residents who were aged 18 and under when the meltdowns occurred have now been diagnosed with thyroid cancer, though the commission stated that, quote, it is difficult to think the cases are related to radiation exposure, end quote, from the disaster. Yeah, well, think a little harder. An academic paper published by the Institute of Medical Science, an ancillary establishment of Tokyo University, states increases in perinatal mortality in prefectures contaminated by the Fukushima nuclear power plant accident in Japan are analogous to jumps in secular European perinatal mortality trends after Chernobyl. Increased infant deaths in areas contaminated with radioactive substances from Fukushima started to increase 10 months after the nuclear accident. We'll link to the full story on nuclear-news.net. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Scientists at the University of Sheffield in the UK have discovered a new way to control uranium contamination. And it's to use, drumroll please, arsenic. Yes, pick your poison. What better way to battle fire than with fire, or a toxic element with another toxic element? An international team of scientists say that the discovery could help in the remediation of former uranium mines and other radioactively contaminated areas around the world. Don't like the uranium? Grab some arsenic! Note that the University of Sheffield also came up with a scheme to drop hot radioactive waste down hundreds of deep shafts across the United States to mix with molten granite in the Earth's crust as a way of disposing of radioactive waste. So when it comes to the University of Sheffield and all of your whack-a-whack-a schemes for dealing with radiation, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, if you value honest, verifiable information on nuclear issues, stories that provide continuity and context for whatever is happening in your area that you care about, delivered with attitude and as much humor as possible, then you have come to value Nuclear Hot Seat. That's why you're listening. I'm grateful for the support you, the listeners, continue to give to Nuclear Hot Seat throughout the year, because without your help, this show would not be able to continue. So if you are grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, please show your support by sending us a donation to help us meet our expenses, be it a one-time donation or a monthly sustaining donation of any amount. It all helps to keep the information flowing out to you, the listeners. Now, we make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send us that one-time or continuing donation. And for an easy, inexpensive way to help us out, you can send the show a monthly $5, the equivalent of buying us a cup of coffee and having a nice tip for the barista. That's easy to do by going to the website and clicking on the big green donate button. Know that whatever you can afford, you're helping to combat the nuclear insanity in all of its many forms by having solid, footnoted, reliably sourced information upon which to base your judgments and your actions. That makes me deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. So thank you. Here's this week's first of two featured interviews. To help bring you up to date on what's happening on-site at Fukushima and surrounding area, I'm again very pleased to have Nancy Faust, communications manager and research team member at simplyinfo.com. SimplyInfo is a not-for-profit research collective that holds and manages the world's largest public archive of data on the Fukushima disaster. Here's the latest.
Nancy Faust, always great to have you back on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be here.
What is going on at Fukushima now? Bring us up to date on the condition of the reactors.
There's been a couple of things that have happened. Wintertime is usually a time where things kind of slow down as far as major big projects, but they'll also go back and do inspection work in the wintertime. Our guess on this is that because the temperatures are not quite as hot, they have problems with heat stroke and things like that in the summer, so they seem to save some of these inspections for the winter time. There's one inspection that's coming up in late January, and that's for Unit 2. They're going to go peek in Unit 2 again. And if anyone remembers back about a year, they had originally set a couple of robots and a scope into Unit 2 to try to find the melted fuel in the pedestal under the reactor. And when they did, they encountered some things they didn't expect, and they found it was much worse than they thought it would be. Now, this new inspection that's happening, they have a new and improved scope. They've given up on using robots for now. This new scope that they have is kind of the latest and greatest. It is supposed to be able to handle 1,000 cyberts of radiation. What this means is it would be able to handle more radiation than any of the equipment they have sent into Unit 2 to date. And this is a big problem they have, is finding equipment and robotic controls that can handle the high radiation so that they can go look at things or do things. So this is one of the big technical challenges. What they're going to do when they put the scope in is they're going to put the scope into the pedestal and then try to go down through the burned hole in the grating and look down the bottom of the pedestal. What they found when they did something similar with Unit 3 was they found a pile of melted fuel. They haven't released all of the information on Unit 3, so we don't know the total condition of that, but that gives you some hints what they may or may not find in the bottom of Unit 2. This is a really big deal because we're reasonably sure that the fuel all fell into the pedestal. Where it went from there is another question because it's not in the other parts of the reactor building, so if it's anywhere, it's in that pedestal or burned down in.
When you say into the pedestal, that's still part of the structure of the unit, but it's possible that it could have burned through to the ground beneath it, as in what would commonly be referred to as China syndrome?
Yes, but it requires a little more explanation. The idea of China syndrome was originally that if a melted reactor core fell out of a reactor vessel and burned through the concrete bottom of a reactor building, that it would keep going and going and going all the way to the middle of the earth, i.e. China. What can happen if the fuel becomes a big enough mass in one place, it can burn down through the thick concrete base mat of the reactor building. If it does that and it reaches groundwater, then you have a big problem. You can have, during the initial meltdown, you can have damage, explosions, things like that. But then you have the reactor core in contact with the Earth groundwater, which can cause some significant amounts of environmental contamination. It also makes cleaning this mess up much more difficult.
So when is this going to be started, and how long is it going to take for the testing, and how long before we will get some indication as to what they find?
Right now, TEPCO has not given the exact date. They said late January. They usually do this so they have some wiggle room if they run into problems or if the weather isn't cooperating. So we would expect sometime in the last 2 weeks of January that they will start on this. They usually announce the day before they're actually going to start the work, they'll usually announce to the press that this is happening. And usually these inspections go on over the period of about 3 days.
Do you have any conjecture as to what might be found?
Well, this has been a big concern of ours. Is we're reasonably sure that Unit 2 did not eject its fuel out of the top of the reactor building, just based on all the information that's pretty well known. Our concern is if the fuel melted down into the concrete bottom of the reactor building, how far did it go? And, of course, this is something TEPCO doesn't want to be very upfront about because it would be extremely bad news for them in a number of ways. So we're kind of waiting to see what they find, and we're hoping they release all of the information from this inspection, including the videos, because many times TEPCO likes to give little snippets of information, but then that's not enough information to really understand what they found. And they really need to be more forthcoming with this information to people.
Let's move over to Unit 3. What has been found there? What is the current status?
Unit 3 had an inspection done in 2017 where they took this little swimming robot, because Unit 3 is partially full of water, so they used this little swimming robot, dropped it in, and they maneuvered it into the pedestal of Unit 3, and they looked around, and they were able to dive it down in one spot and look down in the lower part of the pedestal. And what they had found was melted fuel, evidence of a corium concrete reaction. This is where the melted fuel is burning into the concrete, and basically kind of what we expected to see as far as heat damage and other damage inside the pedestal. What they released towards the end of 2017 was some additional information they got from this inspection but didn't originally tell people about. They found pieces of unmelted fuel assemblies down in the pedestal. And now why this is so strange is the reactor vessel is a big solid piece of metal that has some small holes in the bottom of it that are sealed up with equipment. As a meltdown happens, it burns through the bottom part of that reactor vessel. So you end up with either one giant hole or some small holes where the melted fuel will drip down through. So you would expect anything that was falling down to be melted. But what they found was the top of a fuel assembly, and we don't know how it got there because the evidence shows that the holes in the bottom of the reactor vessel are not huge. They also found a piece of the bottom of a control rod that was unmelted. TEPCO provided no real clear explanations how this happened. They don't seem to know either. So this has become a big question. Nobody knows how these got there, but obviously there is something that happened in the meltdown progressions with Unit 3 that was unexpected or happened in a way that was not anticipated based on, you know, research and understanding of how meltdowns happen. So this will be something we'll be looking at as they do future work inside Unit 3 to try to figure out what on earth happened.
Has the situation stabilized with these reactors? I mean, is the melted fuel still migrating? Is it still leaking?
Is it still radiating?
The water that is coming through and then being released into the Pacific Ocean?
All three units have some situation where the portions of the fuel are in contact with groundwater, in contact with portions of buildings that leak to the environment. So they're always causing a problem. But the idea of a China syndrome where it's burning down and down and down and down is not really what's understood as what happens. What will happen is fuel is hot as it melts, and it stays hot because of the energy within the nuclear fuel. Over time, it does slowly start to cool. But there is one concern we have beyond the environmental contact that these materials may have, is Unit 3 has water standing inside the reactor vessel. You run into conditions where you could start off what's called a criticality, and this is where you start seeing fission in the fuel. If something were to extremely disturb Unit 3, there's always that potential they could kick off a criticality. And what that could do, it could cause an explosion, it could cause high radiation levels in the immediate area of the plant itself. And this is something that, as they're doing research towards cleaning up the plant eventually, that is a big concern, is they're trying to put measures in place to prevent a criticality from happening.
The kind of disturbance you're talking about, that could come from what, an earthquake, another tsunami?
It would have to be a pretty severe earthquake. And because we don't fully know the condition of the melted fuel and how it is arranged and piled in the bottom of the reactor vessel or the containment vessel, I mean, there's always that potential, and they just don't know enough. But because it's in water, water acts as a moderator, which allows fission to happen. So that's always a concern. They do some monitoring to try to note if they notice fission is starting to happen again. So they have kind of some warning systems if something starts happening, but they have limited ability to do much about it. So this is always a concern. And as they go towards starting to remove the fuel, they have measures they're trying to put in place, such as putting boron into the water and things like that to try to lower the instance of something like that potentially happening.
Why are these inspections of the fuel and the sampling of the fuel so important at this time?
Finding the fuel will also give insights into how the meltdowns happened. So things like, you know, the arrangement of the fuel, the condition of it, what it looks like. Also sampling is really important, and this is something they haven't quite gotten to yet, or if they have, they're not telling people. If they can sample these melted fuel substances, this will tell them things about how the meltdowns progress. It'll also tell them things about, like, the releases to the environment. So those little bits of information are really important to both understanding the disaster and how it happened and its impact on people, and also how they're going to deal with this in the future. But part of why they may be reluctant with this is any admission of further information of how these meltdowns happened or its impact on the environment would be inconvenient for TEPCO and the government in Japan, because they would have to admit further the extent of the disaster.
Do you think they would have done that already?
Oh, well, that's been a constant challenge.
Let's move this on, because Fukushima is not the only issue with reactors in Japan. There has been a big push by TEPCO to restart the reactors at Kashiwazaki Kariwa, and they have gained approval. What's the current status there?
The current status is that TEPCO has gained approval from the nuclear regulators to restart two units at this plant. What they haven't gained yet is local consent. And there are laws in Japan that require them to get local consent, at least from the prefecture level, from their governor, that allows the plant to operate. And they have not done this yet. They've been through two governors through this process since the disaster. The second governor has upheld what the first governor said, that we want answers about the Fukushima disaster before we're willing to sign off on allowing any unit at this other plant to restart. So they're back at this stalemate. This also puts extreme pressure on this governor because this is holding up TEPCO's main ability to make money. The government has always considered restarting TEPCO's other reactors as a way to make money to pay for the disaster so the government doesn't have to pay as much. So there's this motivation between the government and TEPCO to restart these plants. And, of course, the local government is reluctant because they saw what happened in Fukushima.
I also understand that as of next month in February, simplyinfo.org is going to be coming out with your annual report on Fukushima. What do we have to look forward to there?
We're going to cover, you know, every year we cover what's happened and what's been found that's new information. There's a lot of information that didn't come directly from TEPCO, but instead came from academic sources. So this is kind of an interesting change as, you know, there's more outside research into what happened. So there will be some of that. We're also looking into taking the information that's been found this year and refining some of our understanding to share with everyone else as far as what happened with the meltdowns and, you know, what's kind of currently known. And you know, as the years go on, information is kind of slower, you know, because there's less happening, less information is being released. There's fewer events because they're, you know, trying to kind of do forensics on this whole mess. But these bits of information that do slowly come out are usually a pretty big deal. So we may have some interesting revelations this year.
We look forward to learning what's in that report and also possibly speaking with you again just about the time that that comes out, Nancy.
Great. I look forward to being back.
And we look forward to having her back. Nancy Faust of simplyinfo.org. In this second interview, we talk with Sean McGee, who is one of the stalwarts with nuclear-news.net. Sean always has insights into what's happening in nuclear Europe. Here, we go over the mystery radiation releases that happened throughout 2017 and cover some of the UK's reactor problems.
There were a lot of radiation releases coming from either Europe or Eastern Europe through 2017. Give us a rundown as to what those were and what the consequences may be or what the implications are of them.
Now, we started off the year, obviously, with a hangover from the 2016, which was the release from the Norwegian reactor. And, of course, there were some issues found with the reporting of those releases. They were left very late before the public was involved. And then we found there was another release at the start of the year, around February and March, and we were trying to decide where that was coming from. Nobody came up with a definitive answer. But once again, I was looking at some of the sort of data that I was looking at, and I thought that also could have come from Norway. But on the other hand, there was a secondary place in Hungary, in Europe, where it could have came from. Coming on to the ruthenium 106 pollution releases that were being reported for the last few months now. It started off in September, obviously, when we were looking at releases that were being found as far east as Kazakhstan and Russia, and all the way over to into Europe as well. And there was various weather events happening at the time, which meant that the actual pollution could have come from Mayak, made its way east against the jet stream, because the jet stream was pretty non-existent around that time, as we discovered. But obviously, we were still looking at it, and people were sort of throwing accusations at one another. The Russians were saying it was the Europeans were saying it was the Russians, but nobody was actually zeroing in on what it might have been. And I think we got up to about December the 12th, and I decided I was going to do an article because still nobody was really admitting that they were responsible for these ruthenium 106 releases. So I actually did an article.
You did this article for nuclear-news.net?
That's correct. I put an article up called Ruthenium 106 Investigation Update, 12th of December 2017, Who is Lying and Why? And so I then looked at the theories, the posits that were put down, to where the actual releases were from. But I actually also looked a little bit wider, and I was trying to find out where ruthenium-106 was being produced. So I actually dug into Hungary. I found that they were doing testing of ruthenium-106, various experiments to find out how to work with that material. And it was specific to ruthenium-106 as well. And they were running experiments for the last few years now. And of course, if they, as they make the ruthenium, it's very volatile. It's a metal that's, that volatilizes at a very low temperature. So it basically would be lofted up into the air. Basically, what I was doing was looking at ruthenium-106 being basically produced in Hungary, and which is kind of between Kazakhstan and the French La Hague place, where which the Russians were trying to claim. But the point is, though, with Hungary, it's always been a very sensitive spot for the nuclear industry, and the IAEA has always tried to defend any accusations of pollution coming from the actual site. That's number one. And there was a second issue that came up with my research, and this was a much bigger issue, is the fact that the nuclear industry will delay the findings of these releases. They don't want people to find out too early, because you can actually track where they're coming from fairly quickly. And if they're left later, of course, some of the isotopes have degraded, the other isotopes have been weathered away, and they're much harder to find the source of where these things come from. So for this ruthenium-106 one was quite interesting. It was nearly 3 months before we got a definitive, yes, it was us. And the same place was also denying it for quite a period of time.
That would be MIAC that we're talking about as having finally admitted that they were the source of it?
That's correct, yes. Russian processing plant at MIAC. And they were obviously denying it profusely before. But I just wonder if I hadn't touched on a very sensitive subject, that there may have been more than one source of ruthenium-106. You know, although they were trying to say, where is it from? There was actually under a dozen places on the planet where you could definitely track ruthenium-106 to. And that would make it very easy to track any releases if you wanted to find it, especially using the back-end radiation monitoring systems that the IAEA has access to.
Given that this release was tracked over, I believe the reports came initially from France and from Germany, meaning that it was being deposited over Europe, what are the implications if, for example, somebody wants to travel to those countries? Is it something to be alarmed about, or is it just part of the ever-increasing background junk of radiation that we're being subject to all over the place?
Well, of course, we are sort of surrounded by this man-made radiation particles and gases and what have you all the time. But I would say with the health effects of this particular one, the idea being is that if we're looking at it as being just one type of release, it depends where it happened. Say if it happened in Hungary, and, you know, which is one of my posits, that it may partially have something to do with that. If it was just from Hungary, we would expect to see some heavy contamination around the two places in Hungary that create this 106. So we would expect local people to certainly have possibly some health effects, you know, if not from ruthenium-106, then one of the daughters, which have much higher gamma and give a much higher dose and much more damage to cells. If we presume it was from MIAC, well, then maybe the people that live near MIAC were certainly at high risk. And for the rest of us, of course, it's just some more particles in the air that we may ingest, more chance of ingesting these particles and increasing our chances of getting cancer or some health effects, a small amount. You know, we wouldn't put a huge statistical amount on that, but we would say, yes, that would add to the background risk of getting cancers or other health effects from radiation.
I understand also that there has been news of radiation releases from China, specifically dealing with iodine-129. What's that one about?
Well, we had a report, and it was on the 30th of December, just when you know most people were looking for this sort of article. It was
only you, Sean, only people like you and me would be looking for this kind of an article.
At 8:30 in the morning. And it was written by Stephen Chen. And he's based in China. And he reports for scmp.com, which is one of the Chinese publishers. And the actual headline is quite interesting because, along with our theme of people not admitting where radiation comes from, he says, the headline I'll read out is, "What caused radiation spikes in Xi'an? North Korean blast, European accident, or one closer to home?" They didn't mention Russia, but that might be the one closer to home. We don't know. Now, to be honest with you, iodine-129 can come from nuclear weapons, right? It's a very long-living isotope as well. So, you know, once it's in the environment, it can be found. But they were saying that the city 2,000 kilometers from the North Korean nuclear test site, they'd actually found this spike in iodine-129 levels. And they said that it was probably not related to the detonation of the 100 kiloton hydrogen bomb in North Korea on September the 3rd. And it is more likely, they said, and this is Chinese scientists, they are saying that it's more likely that it's originated in Europe. So this is quite interesting. So we're having a spike of iodine-129. Now, how would travel from Europe? I mean, that's maybe 4,000 kilometers.
Wouldn't it leave some kind of a trail along the way if it did originate from there?
Well, for instance, if you look at Hungary, the actual, what they call, well, the chimneys or the stack are very tall. When they've got very, very hot gases, the gases will come up the flue. And depending on the weather system, it may well go up into the higher atmosphere and it may be able to travel a long way, you know, and pretty, it will, Boyle's law says that everything will expand at a certain rate. But with clouds of radioactive contamination and with particles in, you find that the electrons will keep these clouds together a bit longer than they would otherwise be kept, you know, because of molecular bonding, basically. They don't want to do what Boyle said, is that the gas will just fill up the room and you'll have a certain percentage in each part of the room, a nice even sort of covering, which ultimately will happen to any gas that's released. But when you put particles in there and you've got charged particles and radiation particles that have a charge, that we have seen that some of these clouds can stick together. There is some science to back that up. And if we're talking about the jet stream as well, which in September, there wasn't much of a jet stream in September. So it's going to be interesting to see how that traveled from Europe. But we're just saying this is what the Chinese are saying. Now, on the other hand, when they're saying or closer to home, well, within 2,000 kilometers, well, that's somewhere in China. So did we have a release of iodine-129 in China? What could cause that? Well, China is very big in medical isotopes, and it may well be that iodine-129 is just a waste product of other isotopes that they're trying to create. So they keep those ones, and then they just loft up the iodine-129 that they don't need. Because they obviously want not these long-term, low-dose ones for medical. They like the short-living, high-energy sort of isotopes. So, I think that's probably responsible, probably for at least some of the releases that we get, that we hear about. But I just thought it was quite nice on the 30th of December, just to get this last little report in for 2017, with yet another radiation release. So how healthy is nuclear? This is what we know about, and we go out, we a lot of bloggers and, you know, people like Krerad and Bellona, they go out and they try to find where this stuff is. And, you know, anyway, so if 2017 was going to have a Numb Nuts of the Year award for science, it would be how to trace one of the easiest things in the world to trace, which is, you know, they use it in the sea to trace tides and all this kind of stuff. It's, they use it in pipes because it finds leaks easy. But can they find a massive amount of this stuff? No, that's all I can say, you know.
With it happening on December 30th, all I can think of is goodbye 2017. Don't let the door kick you on the way out. let's take a look a little bit closer to home, or at least your home. What is happening in Europe and in the UK regarding nuclear to kind of bring us up to date as we launch into 2018?
We've seen a lot of bad nuclear news. We've looked at the French reactors that have had cracks, and there's been bad quality metal casting and what have you from the Kobe in Japan. We've heard problems with various components from South Korea. We're hearing now that France's President Emmanuel Macron, he wants to cut the size of the nuclear fleet in France, but they still want to be selling it to other countries. And, you know, apart from Africa and various other places, they're actually also trying to sell their reactors in China. In China specifically, and we've been getting a lot of hits from China on nuclear-news.net, what's happened there is that there's a growing anti-nuclear movement in China, and they've got some clout. And they're not being targeted like some of the human rights guys are. It may partially be because the Chinese are actually investing more money in renewables than nuclear. Although they've got the biggest nuclear fleet or orders or whatever in the world, it's tiny compared to what they're doing with wind and solar and hydro. So, and especially wind and solar, there's been huge increases there. Anyway, the Chinese government have been trying to work with the French to find sites by the coast, you know, never mind global warming and rising sea levels. So they're going to put them by the coast, but they're going to be keeping them very quiet so that the locals don't find out about it, because there's been a lot of pushback. To move a little bit nearer into the UK, we had a report done by Climate News Network by Paul Brown in London on the 29th of December, this one. And he was saying that the Energy Secretary, Sir Edward Davy, who actually signed off on the Hinkley Point nuclear power station deal, he said that the economics have clearly gone away. And he doubted that the building would ever be completed. And of course, we're talking, that's Chinese and French and South Korean as well.
And this is Hinkley Point that he's talking about?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, he's talking specifically about Hinkley Point, but I think it has a wider implications. I mean, if Hinkley Point isn't economical, well, what is, you know? Dumping radioactive waste from Hinkley, where it's polluted all the sediment in the Bristol Channel, what they've decided to do is it's a bit too radioactive, so they're going to pull it up, going to dredge it all up, and they're going to dump it just near Cardiff, which is in Wales. And it's one of the larger cities in Wales where there's lots of people living, lots of people in the Gower Peninsula that's near there. It's one of the most famous places in the UK for the warmest, sunniest days, the longest, warmest, sunniest days, where people go to the beach, especially young people. They go and party down there. And then there's another section for old people and children and families. And basically, the Gower Peninsula on one side has got old munitions testing sites, so there's old bombs and things in it. And then when you go across to Cardiff and just past there, they're going to be dumping all this radioactive waste. And then it's going to have this, what they call sea to land transfer, where you're going to get little particles, uranium and plutonium and whatever else that Hinkley's been putting out, will be actually be lofted into the air and within a few miles, which certainly covers the area of Cardiff and all the coastal sites that people use for their summer holidays.
We will, of course, be checking in with you as the year goes on to find out more about what you're seeing as regards the European shenanigans. And I want to thank you for joining us this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure.
That was Sean McGee of nuclear-news.net. Activist shout out. First of all, fasten your seatbelts, St. Louis and the rest of the country, because as of February 12, Atomic Homefront is going to be shown on HBO. This is the look at the Westlake landfill with its illegally buried nuclear waste and the fight that has gone on against it by Just Moms STL and also the Clearwater Creek Just the Facts Please group. It is a stunningly powerful documentary that was covered on Nuclear Hot Seat number 332 from October 31st, Halloween. What an appropriate day. HBO being HBO, there are going to be multiple showings, but see it in that first one if you can on the 12th of February. Get a viewing party together, grab on to each other and hang on, because it is quite an emotional ride that deserves to lead to a massive amount of action and reaction. This Thursday, January 18, up in Ottawa, Canada, there's going to be a protest demonstration of the proposed nuclear waste dump that could be coming to the Chalk River. People are invited to join the march through downtown Ottawa, accompanying the Red Canoe to raise awareness around nuclear safety and the giant radioactive mound that a multinational consortium wants to build beside the Ottawa River, upstream of Ottawa-Gatineau. They are currently raising awareness and opposition for a 7-football-field-sized radioactive waste deposit site that's going to be located less than 1 kilometer from the Ottawa River. The march will congregate at Parliament Hill at 1 a.m., and if you can be there, be there. And Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation was in attendance in Oslo, Norway, for the granting of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. She has written a stunning article on this, which appeared in The Nation. We will have a link to it up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 343. And there's a part of the article where she quotes Beatrice Finn, the head of ICAN, in her speech given at the awards that I think would provide the basis of a brilliant choral work if any of my composer friends out there feel that they are up to a work of magnificence. In her words, she stated, "The United States choose freedom over fear. Russia choose disarmament over destruction. Britain choose the rule of law over oppression. France choose human rights over terror. China choose reason over irrationality. India choose sense over senselessness. Pakistan choose logic over Armageddon. Israel choose common sense over obliteration. North Korea choose wisdom over ruin." Can't you just imagine that with a bunch of choral voices singing it out? I'm up for it. If you come up with it, let me know. I'll play it on the show. Here's today's final thought. When I was 9 years old, growing up in Chicago in the 50s, terrified on a daily basis of nuclear bombs going off, the 1959 White Sox won the American League pennant in a night game. This was a big deal. To celebrate, Mayor Daley gave the order for the air raid sirens to be set off. Now, these were usually tested every Tuesday morning at 10:30, so we knew the sound and that we could be alerted to a nuclear attack when we heard it. Suddenly, that night, in my bed, I heard that warning siren and immediately was overcome with a total terror. It was happening. The unthinkable was happening. And my family was not responding. They were celebrating the baseball victory. They didn't respond to the sirens. So I got up out of bed and tried to rally them to follow me down to our basement because the Russians were about to drop the bomb. My family laughed at my fears and ordered me back to bed, claiming it was all because of the baseball game. So I went back to bed, my fears unacknowledged, uncomforted, and I can still remember the gut-level terror I felt from the first sounding until I finally fell into an exhausted sleep several hours later, thinking that at any moment it could be the last. The next morning, as my family continued to make jokes at my expense, I could not shake the feeling. It was and is existential and unforgettable. Last Saturday, the people of Hawaii faced that same situation, technologically enhanced by cell phone auto messages. For 38 minutes, they lived in nuclear limbo, told they had 15 minutes to find shelter from a nuclear attack, as if there is any shelter possible from a nuclear bomb. Representative Tulsi Gabbard's people tracked it down and announced a false alarm after 10 minutes,
but they only made that announcement on Twitter. They did not have access to the larger notification system. She did what she could, but it did not stop the terror. And for once, aren't we fortunate that we have a president who cares more about his golf game than paying attention to what might have been construed as a genuine nuclear attack by North Korea and ordered the U.S. nuclear football into action? It could have gone there. Donald Trump is no Stanislav Petrov, and he might have even relished being the one to push that ugly button. I read stories of the people in Hawaii going through the false alarm and can relate to every adrenaline-pumped heartbeat. That's what I felt at Three Mile Island when I heard the announcement go down the street as well. To give you an idea, here's one outreach letter I received from a listener in Hawaii, Malia Madamalama Schlesser. She wrote, "It never occurred to me that this might be a false alarm, since here in Hawaii, we've been listening to North Korea's missile dangers for weeks. We have monthly drills with sirens, etc. The feeling that came over me at that moment is something I will never forget. It was absolutely terrifying. I mean, we have all been in planes with turbulence and felt unsettled, or waited for the results of a blood test thinking, what if? Even my 91-year-old dad told me this morning that during World War II, when you heard the bombs, you were seeking shelter, but you always hoped. It wasn't definite. This feeling we all felt yesterday was not maybe, and hopefully the bomb will hit the other side of the island. It was, this is a nuclear attack, and in about 12 minutes, we will be dead. It was awful. During those 12 minutes, I sat in the bathroom, as if that would make a difference, and waited, looking at the clock, trying to reach anyone. 911 also wouldn't have made a difference. Trying to find something on the news on my computer, sitting on the closed lid of the toilet, my teenage daughter on the floor next to me. As the minutes ticked by, I was just trembling. That's all I remember. And my reptilian brain taking precedent and me just thinking, we will be dead in about 5 minutes. Once the all clear came, 38 minutes after the first warning, there was no relief. We went to the living room and turned on the TV, saw the coverage coming in from everywhere, but no one did a happy dance. No one was so happy to be okay. That came later, but only to be replaced by anger. The relief came in the form of silence, trying to process what had just happened. People are angry. People are emotionally scarred by this, some more, some less. Do we blame the president? Do we blame the poor soul who pushed the wrong button? Where do we go from here? Where do you go and who do you blame? Blame nukes and their very existence. Then take your post-traumatic stress disorder, because that's what you and everyone else in Hawaii who went through this is suffering from. And use that energy to fuel your fight back. Plug into the larger international battle. Check out ICANW.org, which stands for the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons. That's the group that just won the Nobel Peace Prize for its work to ban nuclear weapons. And find a chapter or found a chapter in your area. They will give you the materials you need. Check out DontBankOnTheBomb.com and learn how you can go to your bank and demand that they divest from nuclear weapons manufacturers. Organize. Yes, you, my dear listener, your daughter, and everyone else in Hawaii, you are all in shock. You are all reeling from facing the worst thing we can face on Earth, mass annihilation, and the certain feeling that there is nothing that we as an individual can do about it. But you can. So start now, right away. Talk to friends, neighbors, relatives, people you stand in line with at the grocery store. Write letters to the editor. Book talks at libraries, schools, community centers. Do consciousness raising like we used to do back in the feminist 60s and 70s. Engage your daughter and her friends in it, and do not stop. Hawaii, take the lead. You have faced the worst. It didn't happen, but that doesn't mean you didn't face it. And the only way to combat the existential terror that you have now lived and that will live with you always is to fight back. Share this information, share your rage, share the pain, and take action, because we are not yet helpless. We have more than the next 15 minutes. What the people of Hawaii lived through was dress rehearsal for nuclear hell. If we all take action now, that dress rehearsal will never turn into an opening night, which will be the ultimate closing night for people and the planet. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 16, 2018. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net and Sean Arklight, deunrenard.wordpress.com, and Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, rabble.ca, thenation.com, npr.org, diy.rootsaction.org, seattletimes.com, Susanna Frame on Twitter and at king5.com, Annette Carey and try-cityherald.com, ewg.org, truth-out.org, capecod.com, capecodtimes.com, and Christine Legere, 6abc.com in New Jersey, mothersforpeace.org, sfchronicle.com, nears.org, and Tim Judson, theguardian.com, thinkprogress.com, huffingtonpost.com, washingtonspectator.org, mainichi.jp, japantimes.co.jp, beyondnuclear.org, asahi.com, nonukes.nl, canada.ca, defense1.com, and Joe Circioni, the karmically damaged cubicle slaves grinding out press releases for World Nuclear News, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission event reports, and a shout out to you, Nuclear Hot Seat listeners in 123 countries around the world, who show your love for life on this planet by being the kick-ass defenders of nuclear truth and supporters of nuclear awareness that you are. Let's shut this bugger down. Thanks for gathering at the Nuclear Hot Seat blog site on Facebook, and if you haven't gone there yet, be sure to stop by, click like, post, and share. You can get Nuclear Hot Seat automatically every week if you go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com. Look for the email box, sign up, weekly email link to your latest show. Promise I won't bug you with email. It's one a week. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2018, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And a reminder that if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation to nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, once again reminding you that the nuclear arsenal really represents a self-destruct button for the human race. Let's not let anyone push it. There. You've just had your nuclear wake-up call. Now don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.